The Ocelli Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ocelli.
April 13, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this is indeed the show you were looking for. How do I know this? Because you're hearing me say this. Anyway, Woden's Day, Wednesday, the middle of the week. And maybe my mic is a little hot, so I'm going to bring that down just a touch. You know, I was producing a show before this, so no mic on there. But definitely keeping it live on the network. Anyway, this is going to be an interesting 2 hours. Tell you, last Wednesday, couldn't do Wednesday's show because, the place was hit by lightning. So, you know, kind of takes you out of the game for a little while. Internet doesn't work after that. Electricity doesn't work after that. And quite frankly, you might feel a little confused, too. So anyway, last Wednesday's show got canceled, but that's okay. We put together something even more interesting tonight. Johnny Venmore is with us in the first hour, and I probably just screwed up his name, but don't worry, he can correct me in a second. Arthur Kangas, and who knows, maybe I'm screwing up that name too. We'll get to that momentarily, because, you know, I read things, I hear things, and sometimes I confuse them, and people's names, I don't know, maybe it's also just a little spite thing, because everybody screws up mine. Anyway, Arthur Kangas, and also Mr. Gallup will be with him, so actually two guests in the second hour. But let's get on with it because I started a couple of minutes late. Johnny Venmore, now, before I go anywhere and try and introduce you or anything like that, I know that a lot of my listeners have already read an article, okay, that mm-hmm. has something to do with this guy Schwab. And I got to tell you, it's a fascinating topic, and I'm going to let you introduce yourself, okay? But let me lay this out on the table for you. I was born in 1972, right? So I just turned 50 like a week ago. Exactly a week ago. Okay, anyways, the thing is, to me, I as a little kid, right, I like the Elmer Fudd cartoons. And I'll tell you, now he's going, what direction is this guy going in? Is he stoned? No, I'm not. Elmer Fudd and this guy that was the former Secretary of State kind of sounded familiar to me. Mm-hmm. They seemed like they were related. This guy, Kissinger, sounded a lot like Elmer Fudd to me in a weird sort of way when I was a little kid. Now, I have learned that Elmer Fudd is much less nefarious than this gentleman, okay, over the years. And there's a lot to be said about Mr. Kissinger's role in American history, but this will come into the Schwab story. And meanwhile, again, before I started really reading your stuff, and I'd seen mentions of this individual Schwab before in financial circles and stuff like that, gotta tell you, I didn't pay much attention to it. So anyway, let's get to introducing who you are, sir. And did I screw up your name? Venmore?
No. You got it really good. Johnny Venmore is my name. Don't wear it out, as they say.
Sure.
No, you can wear it out if you want.
Cool.
I am an investigative journalist. I'm a writer. I'm a researcher. I go deep into stuff. I tend to look for areas that no one else has tackled yet are really really focused on. So the World Economic Forum was focused on the creation of the World Economic Forum, less so. The actual, when you heard the history, you say, oh, this Klaus Schwab set up this World Economic Forum in 1971, and then all of this stuff happened. And it's not quite true. Of course, like any story, it's a carefully constructed, and there's not much there to carefully construct. And that's one of the things I do. I look for things that no one else finds, and Klaus Schwab was definitely a candidate for that, seeing as no one knew about his family history. There were a couple of rumors here and there, a couple of groups on things, various Reddit threads and stuff where people had put together like ideas of who he was. And I starting off, I decided, let's look through all of those, let's write all down all of the rumors, let's then go into China, actually find out who Klaus Schwab's father was.
Right.
And what the story behind the creation of one of the now most powerful men in the world.
Well, see, this is the funny thing. Okay, so here's a funny thing, because I remember a Reddit thread trying to equate Charles Schwab and Klaus Schwab, right?
Yeah.
And Charles Schwab, now that's the name of a brokerage company, right? Look, I don't have any money, so I don't know this stuff. But the thing is that I'm aware of that.
Charles Schwab was a big industrialist investor in the day. Extremely big. I mean, he was extremely famous. No relation at all, but go on, sorry.
Right, but that's the weird thing, is that I saw this and I went, wait a minute, I know that guy was a big investment. Like, literally, he was an investor for real. He actually put out capital and invested in many things. There's a huge history behind that as to why that company is named that. And meanwhile, people bring up the World Economic Forum and talk about Klaus Schwab, but it's just right by. It's in a blurb. It's done. It's a sentence at best. And I go, okay. Now, it's interesting that Charles Schwab is on the name of that company. But, you know, that makes perfect sense. Again, but the idea that Klaus Schwab and this whole thing with the World Economic Forum, which, again, people just mention it in passing, and that's it. Very weird. So, like, what was it that inspired you to dig into this when it seems like, I mean, no offense to you, but it almost seems like nobody wanted to hear it?
It's very true. But we got down to a point. I was me and Whitney Webb were around a coffee table in Chile. It sounds all very tropical or etc. to me when I'm sitting in Wales. But we were sitting around a coffee table in Chile, and we were trying to work out how we focus in on the World Economic Forum properly to make people understand what's actually happening, mm-hmm. and how pernicious some of the behaviour is, and how it obviously only leads in one direction. How they're telling you out loud everything that's going on, and we realized that there were holes to all of the Schwab background story. And I started off by looking into family histories. Mm-hmm. I started off by going into a reporter in the UK called Laura Koonsberg, who's a political editor for the BBC, and her family history. Found out her father was in a sweatshop, managed a sweatshop in Peru, and managed to take away all the rights when rights got introduced into the country through laws and regulations at the time. And then I researched Theresa May's family history just before the election in 2017 and discovered her father had worked with a serial killer called John Bodkin Adams, who had killed over 130 people who he had injected with a lethal injection when acting as their doctor, after getting them to sign all of their property over to him in their wills.
Is that the same guy who was also involved in the corpse harvesting stuff too? That same serial killer, or am I mixing them up? Because
no, I don't think it is, but I wouldn't be surprised if something like that was involved at the time. Her Theresa May, who was the Prime Minister of UK at the time, her father was the a chaplain of Eastbourne Hospital at the time, so he would have done all of the last rites and things like that, gone down to the morgue. They countersigned the death certificate. And afterwards, he got a very cushy job in one of the best churches in a place called Oxford. Just near a place called Oxford. And he was then a vicar to the wealthy after that, which was very convenient. And then I did Bill Gates' family history. I went back 700 years into Bill Gates' family history and discovered that he's a direct descendant of George Gates III, I think his name is, who got his head chopped off on the first day Bloody Queen Mary took the throne for trying to do a coup. To run in the family. He was actually one of the pallbearers of Henry VIII when Henry VIII died, and had his son's ear for the short amount of time that he was king and alive. So I had really looked into family histories. Deep into things.
So I need to ask a couple of quick questions. Just clarify for American listeners really quickly, because first of all, the fact that I brought up the corpse harvesting thing is because I've actually investigated some of the British, or, you know, let's call them the United Kingdom-based serial killers, which a lot of Americans do not know anything about, to be honest with you. They think we have all the serial killers. We don't. They just think, oh, Jack the Ripper, you know, that's it. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you said a vicar. Can you describe what a vicar is to an American listener who goes, I don't even know what that, what's a vicar?
Vicar is basically a priest who's in charge of the church, has his own little church, and then he runs the church as it is through part of the Church of England's process. For this is why the article was so interesting, though, because it wasn't really about the fact that Father had worked with this serial killer, but the area where they were working, loads of the priests there all got arrested and revealed to be child abusers, including links with Jimmy Savile and people. And then Theresa May's Home Secretary was in charge of what was definitely a cover-up of all of those cases. And her father would have known all of those people because he was in the same diocese, church diocese, so church-like region, as these people. And included people like Canon Peter Ball, who was a friend of Prince Charles. There was obviously loads of cases, so it was an extremely interesting there's lots of cases, and I'm discovering one now which is a serial killer case where it was never even investigated because the people involved were so powerful.
Right.
So there's loads more in Britain. Is serial killing, I think, was a fad, a trend for a very long time. Yeah. It didn't only come out in Jack the Ripper and other people, and that essence of Jack the Ripper like echoed through time. I don't think people realize how influential Jack the Ripper's mystery was to the whole of the world. The idea of tabloid papers only happened once Jack the Ripper murders happened. Right. Then people started reporting about the most gruesome, horrible, nasty things, and within 10 years they started to be called tabloid newspapers because of that, and because of what they had done with the Ripper, where they had reported on loads of stuff that just wasn't true. So it's a really interesting, there's loads of murders that have happened right. in Britain. This is a very weird place with very weird people who do very weird stuff on a very regular basis.
Well, right, and that was part of my point, is that honestly a lot of American listeners again think that, you know, we got a guy with a body count of, you know, 10, 15, 20 people, and I go, that's a joke compared to some of the stuff that I've looked at in Great Britain, where you know, you've got dozens of bodies.
Loads are unsolved, like especially kids who just have gone missing and have never even talked about. It's real sad stuff. I'm about to tell the story of six women who were murdered, and they're murdered with connection to royal family, to the state, and it's all been covered up. They all got put down as accidental murder. Even one of them got garroted, defensive wounds, had like a non-lethal overdose, and yet it was still put down as an accidental death. There's lots of the establishment, the closer you get to the halls of power, and power in the Anglo-American world, we have to realize, we have to accept, we're combined. You know, right. When I watch the news over in Britain, most of the time all we're watching is American news and what's going on in Canada, what's going on in Australia. We've never really given up colonialization. We've never given up the empire in itself. And the Anglo-American empire is really what this whole Schwab thing leads back to as well.
Right. Okay, no, I just wanted to clarify that before you move forward, and now I'll just shut up and let you get on with that story. But I just wanted to make that very clear to American listeners that if you think Murder and Mayhem has high body counts in America, you know nothing. Because Great Britain has huge plethoras of these patterns, and a lot of them do remain unsolved decades later, many decades in some cases. So I just wanted to make that point, and go ahead and tell us about it if you don't mind.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, Britain, growing up here, you tend to, I mean, my first school projects in English were about serial killers, you know, Myra Hindley, Jack the Ripper, and others. That was, you know, we have a fascination with most of the things of murder mystery, most of the things that are on TV, the dramas and stuff, are murder mysteries, and we have a fascination with murder, and I think it's wrapped up in our royal history. And that history kind of affects the world, and it affects the world in a way that's still happening today because of an idea of what Britain was in the past and how it could continue to control the world. And we will get to that. But the article that I wrote most recently is called Dr. Klaus Schwab. And of course has a theme in the rest of the title on Dr. Strangelove, because they are heavily connected. It's amazing that they're heavily connected. My original research of looking into Schwab's family history discovered that Eugen Schwab, his father, you can't make it up, worked in a model Nazi company. And he was a manager of a factory. It wasn't any old factory. It was in a place called Ravensburg, which is in a place called Schwobia. And now, Charles Schwab, for instance, would have probably had ancestry that would go all the way back to Schwobia, because Schwab is from Schwobia, people from Schwobia. It's like if your name's Billy Welsh and you're from Wales, or you're Johnny English or whatnot. There was this whole area called Upper Schwobia, extremely rich area. When people protest in Berlin, which is very poor up north, and they protest against the rich people, they say down with Schwobia. So there was lots of rich people that come from Schwobia, but Klaus Schwab's father, Eugen, ran a factory in Ravensburg for Escher Weiss Company, and Escher Weiss was originally a Swiss company, but even though it had a branch in Switzerland, it operated its branch in Germany kind of separately. And as the war built got going, World War II, Ravensburg got special permission through the Red Cross not to be bombed by Allied forces, and at the same time, it was manufacturing heavy water turbines for the Nazi atomic bomb project that was happening up in Norway. So this was an extremely important area, and Eugen Schwab, Klaus Schwab's father, was the manager of this model Nazi company that was producing these very important parts for the Nazi atomic bomb project. When I discovered that, I mean, you could say you just evacuate your bowels. It's like a shock. I thought that's all it's going to be. But then as I followed the journey on, I discovered that Klaus Schwab had gone on to very diplomatic in his teenage years. He had learned how to talk with French and German people who needed to get over the war, of course, because there was a lot of pain, and he would, you know, tell them all stories. Klaus Schwab was very young during the war. He would have been 4 or 5, 6 when it ended, 6, 7 when it ended. He was born in 1938, so it's not like he experienced the war fully. He would have seen certain parts of it, but his area, like I say, the area he was in, was completely and utterly protected. And his father's company used slave labor. They didn't use Jewish labor or death camp labor, but they did use slave labor from people who were captured mainly in Poland and places like that in Eastern Europe. And of course, we all know that the Nazis didn't actually manage to get the atomic bomb, that would have changed the war if they had. And Klaus Schwab went on to become a very clever young man who would get lots of different degrees and qualifications, attend loads of courses, get lots of honors. And his father in 1964, Eugen Schwab, would say, "Klaus, you need to go to Harvard if you want to succeed in the world." But Harvard was more interesting than just, "Oh, you've got to go to Harvard." You see, whenever Klaus Schwab tells you a story like that as well, because that is from Klaus Schwab's own mouth, whenever he tells you a story like that, you know there's more to be found in whatever words he says. Harvard at the time in 1964 was the center of the thermonuclear war discussion, debate, the agenda itself. Henry Kissinger was the head of government there, the professor of government. He was very influential from the late 50s onwards after writing Thermonuclear War and Foreign Policy. And he had links with other people in Harvard. They had created a course. He hadn't created it. A guy called William Yandel Elliott, who was an advisor to 6 presidents and one of the members of the Council on Foreign Relations. A very high up member, obviously. He would take Kissinger at McGeorge Bundy's request, who was a Harvard professor. He would suggest, and when Kissinger graduated in 1951, that he should go to the CFR, and then he ran working groups groups on thermonuclear war and how it affects and the dynamics of it. At the same time, the Hudson Institute and a man named Herman Kahn, who's nicknamed the real Dr. Strangelove, would be doing the same sort of things that the Hudson Institute, the RAND Corporation, obviously heavily linked with that. And they would be mapping out, these two men would be mapping out the future, the Cold War era future of politics.
Now, just a quick reminder. Sorry, just a quick reminder to the listeners that that McGeorge Bundy that just went by in that flurry from Johnny Benmore is the same McGeorge Bundy who was an advisor to President John F. Kennedy. Just so you know. Okay.
Yes. Now we're going to get around to that again. Because, you see, these men were obviously had put themselves, Herman Kahn and Dr. Kissinger, had put themselves in a situation to be the front experts for the government on thermonuclear war at a time when it was going to mean all the policies were going to be created around it. You know, the Cold War era was going to be about to stand off about nuclear deterrence. And in 1961, Herman Kahn would write on thermonuclear war, and that was all about the weirdness of the deterrence. Right. How it affects it. The first stage of deterrence is two people have bombs and they don't want to fire it at each other or it'll be the destruction of the world. So they don't. So the second one means there's loads of effects that come from that that are political that then have to be counteracted in some ways. And then the third part, nuclear deterrence, is even more complicated because it's all the things that come from all of those manipulating things that you have to then make it unprofitable for the other side to actually fire nuclear weapons.
And so these all, well, hang on. These all become part of what would be codified later as MAD, Mutually Assured Destructive Deterrent, right? Which, again, was also partially inspired by the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62. But let us not forget that McGeorge Bundy, again, being an advisor to President Kennedy, and also along with who? The chief there of the Pentagon, right? The Secretary of Defense, who would later, and I saw him lecture on this, actually, you know, our friend there from the Fog of War, if you know who I'm talking about.
You talk about McNamara.
Of course.
Well, I was hoping so, because, you know, I am British, so I do try and take in as much information as I can, but sometimes it's hard.
Yeah, it's a very curious situation, though, when you look at the American side of it and what it is that we've been taught about it and what is really not out there outside of the intellectuals at this time. And that's why 64 is a pivotal year. So I just wanted to give you a chance to breathe also and provide people with this context. So by all means, continue, Mr. Benmore.
Okay, so let me shoot a tiny little bit forward because maybe backwards on voice. William Yandell Elliott created a course in the early 50s called the International Seminar, which was about recruiting for projects that obviously the CFR had in the future. And this would develop into a course that Henry Kissinger would become executive director of. And this would be the International Seminar, which Klaus Schwab would attend, because Klaus Schwab says himself, I didn't attend any specific course. I just attended seminars. Well, it turns out it's the International Seminar. And at the time, it was a project on basically training future world leaders, just like the World Economic Forum Young Global Leader. And through that project, Kissinger would introduce this young Klaus Schwab, who was this fantastic intellectual from Europe and was really well placed to have some sort of place in the European dynamic of control for the American Empire during the Cold War. He would introduce them to Herman Kahn, the real Dr. Strangelove, who was obviously associated with him, and another Harvard professor, a guy called John Kenneth Galbraith, who's, of course, this is the reason why I have to get there and come back, because John Kenneth Galbraith is extremely important. He was the man who taught John F. Kennedy. He taught Joseph P. Kennedy in his first year of teaching at Harvard. I think that was like, I can't remember the year, but it was like it was very early on, obviously, the 40s. I think it was about 48. But he would teach Joseph Joseph P. Kennedy, and then 2 years later he would teach John F. Kennedy, and John F. Kennedy loved John Kenneth Galbraith. John Kenneth Galbraith was really important to him. When he was a junior senator of Massachusetts, he would say he was the Phileas Fogg of Europe after John Kenneth Galbraith went off to look around Yugoslavia and Eastern Europe at the agriculture, where John Kenneth Galbraith seems to be like a very interesting spy figure. He had originally meant to train under John Maynard Keynes, the famed economist, but John Maynard Keynes had a heart attack in about 1936, I think this was. He went to study land policies under Hitler in Germany instead, married a woman who had lived with Hitler's girlfriend, a Unity Mitford back in the day. You know, these really weird links. But he, and then when the war happened, John Kenneth Galbraith, of course, comes back to America, takes up a position advising about bombing strategies and things that will happen after the war if they're successful. And then later on, when the war ended, he would be sent to interview Albert Speer, interrogate Albert Speer, who was the head of the Wehrmacht, really. He was the head of the war and armaments for the Reich Minister of the War and Armaments during the war. So obviously one of the most powerful people during the war years, and it was John Kenneth Galbraith who went to speak to him. John Kenneth Galbraith was an economist. It doesn't make any sense. He was this really important man. He would end up being alongside John F. Kennedy during his administration.
Well, not only during his administration, but previous to his administration, where he was actually helping shape part of what would become Kennedy's foreign policy, which, again, was not based in warlike functions. He actually encouraged him about, you know, Southeast Asia and to not become involved in those conflicts, which is very strange if I'm following the writings of everybody correctly here. Like, in other words, Galbraith makes no sense to me, because on the one hand, he is a warmongering guy who wants to participate in putting things in place so that you can win a war. On the other hand, he is a guy who's saying, don't get yourself involved in, like, say, colonial struggles and things like this, which is very weird for a sort of warmongering guy to do. And meanwhile, as you said, he's an economist. What in the hell is he doing? I mean, do you know the answer to that, Johnny Benmore?
I think I do. I think it's a bit weird, you know. It's going to be a bit weird for people. I think you're going to feel it to be true, though. From my working out, these men are all members of the Council on Foreign Relations at this time, and they seem to be a roundtable group in the design of Cecil Rhodes, and were extremely powerful at the time. And inside the CFR, and this is where I say it's a bit uncomfortable for thinking, the CFR was kind of a bit like a democracy. You know, it was a bit weird. In there isn't a load of just authoritarians who all think the same way. It was a load of elites, big players in society. And in there was a guy I mentioned in the last article I wrote called, Morgan Fowle, his name is. And he had a warning about the future of technology in a way that was so, we should have listened to him more than any. But he was a member of the CFR too, and I think the CFR had lots of voices, and some of them were what we would see as maybe left and right, or, you know, liberal or a conservative, but the majority voice there was authoritarian and dystopian, and all of them knew that the people in charge would be the ones who decide what happens anyway. And I think people like John Kenneth Galbraith were seemingly looking like they were fighting against things like the Vietnam War, but that was his position. His position was to look like he was inspecting agriculture when he was really a spy. That looked like he was only concentrating on farm stuff and economy when he was going to be interrogating high-up Nazi officials. To look like he was a peacemaker when in actual fact he was working alongside the people, very people who were creating war. Because at the same time, I think Vietnam has to be seen through a context of a psychological operation in all types of way, including on the American people, on the very psyche of the American people, to make them believe in war, believe that America's right, to such a level and such a degree that they would allow America to be out of control. And it's really difficult to explain this from a British perspective, because you always feel like you're talking externally about something that's very emotional for Americans. Vietnam War is something that's very still resonates with them.
Well, if you're part of my generation, look, you have to recognize that there was a serious operation to undermine, to hamstring, to kneecap the generation previous to me. Our fathers, our uncles, this is a key point, by the way, to me, about my entire worldview, is exactly this. It literally hinges on the criminal act that was the Vietnam War, for personal reasons. And that's the thing. If you can't understand that was strategically done, okay, and I don't mean you, Johnny, I do mean you, the listener. If you can't understand that was strategically done, to literally undermine the strength of our entire culture, I don't know what to tell you, because that's what that operation was designed to do. I mean, of course, there were other benefits for people that benefit from blood for it. I mean, you know, your friends at Halliburton sucked up a company that was totally involved in, guess what, you know, dragging bays and things in Vietnam. Take a look up at, you know, Kellogg, Brown, and Root. If you want to take a look at who benefited, you want to take a look at the military-industrial complex's continuous evolution. And then the way that it's undermined us socially and sociologically and psychologically is a full spectrum. I mean, I have no other words for it. So I don't blame you for not necessarily understanding that in a personal way, because why would you?
Well, by 1968, John Kenneth Galbraith, who's arguing against the Vietnam War during that time, actually yes. protesting against, like, stop the democracy now, stop it, you know, really out there at college campuses, trying to maintain peace and order, so trying to be the establishment's kind of guy to say, hey, everybody, calm down, I'm on your side as well, which I think was one of his functions. Yeah, in 1968, he joins together with the Mandeville Lectures with Kissinger, who's obviously war-hawking it, and say has rhetoric that's like, oh, we should be careful with the Vietnam War, while at the same time pushing towards the Vietnam War more and more at the same time, which is what Kissinger did. I mean, when you said earlier about Kissinger and Elmer Fudd, well, God, man, Kissinger was a really, really professional Elmer Fudd. He had involved in everything, and he always caught the rabbit. That's the difference between Kissinger and Elmer Fudd, is that he actually managed to create all of this mayhem in his wake. Now, what's really interesting, again, like I say, back in this international seminar, Schwab attends, 1965. He leaves Harvard in 1967, at the same time as Pierre Trudeau, the father of Justin Trudeau, which is very interesting, who's on the same course. And this course, I should mention, because I haven't mentioned it to your audience, was discovered in 1967 to be funded by the CIA. So $146,000, quite a lot of money in the 60s, went towards funding this course between 1961 to 1966. Nice. Of course, Klaus Schwab was attending 1965 and 1966. At the same time, Herman Kahn was writing a document that would go alongside his masterpiece Year 2000, which would predict every single technology for the future and is one of the most interesting documents in history. But alongside that, he would also, for the Hudson Institute, while he was also an advisor for the State Department between 1966 and 1968, he'd be writing an ancillary document about the special educational needs for future leaders. And so at the same time where he's being introduced to Klaus Schwab, Herman Kahn, etc., he's actually involved in a project that seems to be the Young Global Leaders at the initial stage, CIA funded, coming out of Harvard. The actual Harvard Humphrey Dorman revealed called it in the Harvard Crimson itself. Uh-huh. It was reported in the newspaper, and no one connected it with Schwab, of course, later on, because time dwindles on, time heals all rooms. Now, Schwab would go on in 1967, when he left this course, to go to his father's company. And here we go. This is really interesting, because he would go back to Escher Weiss. The head of Escher Weiss at the time was this guy, Peter Schmidheiny. His father, Colonel Jacob Schmidheiny, had been the one who had been the boss to Klaus Schwab's father, Eugen Schwab. And Peter Schmidheiny would call up Klaus Schwab and say, "Hey, Klaus, now you've been at Harvard, you understand business management, come manage Escher Weiss in this merger with Schulze AG and Brown Bavaria," who were big companies, Schulze AG especially.
Right. Now, hang just a second. Just a second. You're throwing a lot at me. I want to get an idea from you about something, though, because this is an entire time period where the CIA is funding the future global leaders. And theoretically, to my mind, now this does link to the Rhodes Scholars. You mentioned Cecil Rhodes earlier. Just saying. Now, we all know the famous picture of Bill Clinton shaking hands with JFK. Interesting that he was a Rhodes Scholar. Interesting that he's in that same intellectual soup, so to speak, at this time. Okay, yes. Now I'm not saying he's hanging out with Klaus Schwab, but what I am saying is that, guess what? He's participating in programs that are funded by these same shell companies that we come to find out later are, guess what? Agency. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that, and how many world leaders were probably prepared from, say, 1955 to 1965 to be loosed later. As individuals of influence.
You said that, man. So glad you said that, because it's one thing that nobody's really looked into. You know, there's I've only at the moment with when you write an article like this, it's got lots in it. You have to often concentrate on other parts, and you have to simplify things to a certain extent. But I found four leaders: one Israeli leader, one Japanese leader, one Canadian leader, and Klaus Schwab. Who were trained through this course, but this course went on for years and years. Even running before. Right. I mean, they only admitted to 1961 to 1966. That course had been running since 1951.
Okay, 51. So, but if you consider that time period, this is the last thing I'm going to ask you. If you consider that time period, right, we know about presidents, fine, vice presidents, okay. But here's the thing. The people that work for the State Department, you don't necessarily even know all their names. These people could be agents of influence that are then placed into various sensitive positions afterwards, and unless you have the entire attendance list of all these events, you don't know at this point who ends up in office in the 70s, in the 60s, later in the 60s, in the 80s, in the 90s. Yeah. Okay, and these people, if they were like 18 years old when they were in there in, say, 1960, let's go with that date, okay, so 20 years later, they're 38, they could very easily be working for the State Department, the CIA, the NSA, so on and so forth, and there's tons of these guys. Every time I kick over a stone, to be honest with you, when I go through research, because I do some deep political research, I kick over these guys that I know were CFR funded one way or another. I mean, today you got, what, Max Boot is your big voice coming out of there, right? Max Boot from the CFR. Here he is. Not necessarily the A-team coming out of there anymore. But at a time, I mean, Jimmy Carter, nobody thinks about him being connected to the CFR half the time. But if you examine who was in his cabinet and who were, you know, who was the undersecretary of this, that, the third thing, it was like there was nowhere to turn without CFR people or CFR-funded people. I mean, so, and there's a guy who I put an asterisk next to as not necessarily being controlled by outside influences directly at the head of our government at a certain point. But what I'm saying is there is a matrix here that you're talking about that I think hardly anybody would appreciate unless they really dive deep and take a look at who's actually the undersecretary of this, that, the third thing, who's working in the administrative roles at the top, or next to the top, or maybe they're the advisor.
It's some,
Yeah.
Something really interesting comes out of that, because Harvard have to respond to this Humphrey Dorman report, and they respond in an unnamed article. They don't give they give a title, but they don't give a name to who wrote the article, or who wrote the piece. And they basically said there was no chance that this money could be used to affect things politically, or there's no chance, not politically, in the institution, mm-hmm. and there's no chance for them to teach fake things to people. But it didn't say there's no chance that we trained up future leaders to be installed in other countries. Mm-hmm. And that's what they do at the time. They'll give you all of the reasons why, oh, don't worry, that money the CIA gave us wouldn't have affected this or wouldn't have affected that. But it would affect something much different than what they say. And they can say the truth to you and a lie at the same time, you know?
No, I just wanted to cover that a little bit because, again, you know, people look for the big names, right? The presidents, the vice presidents, like I said, you know, the guys. But the truth is that if you have 500 of these guys and you place them correctly, what kind of control can you exert over policy, over the behavior of a nation, over the behavior of an industry? I mean, this is well planned, is all I'm saying.
I've been studying this with an article I did before, a couple before this one was called The Wellcome Five, looks at the Wellcome Trust's influence on the COVID pandemic, which is extremely, five men who are extremely far reaching. One of them has since 1994 been in charge of giving out grants, lifetime grants to doctors, 35 of them. They choose them from mainly Rhodes Scholars from Oxford, and they bring them in and they do a DPhil Rhodes Scholarship course, where it's obviously you don't know what they're teaching them, but they become part of the unit then. And nearly all of the ones who have gone through this training course are the ones we see on TV. They're the ones we see all the time, but they're not connected to the Wellcome Trust. They're not connected to all of these other things. They're just funded here and funded there by them. They look like they're independent, but they've all gone through this program. And this program is very, this Rhodes Scholarship program is very, it's worrying. CFR is worrying. If you look at the most powerful person who's even more powerful than Kissinger, is a person who put Kissinger in charge in the first place. And I'm not talking about McGeorge Bundy, who's also very powerful, but William Yandel Elliott is one of the most powerful people I think America's never heard of.
Yeah.
It's completely crazy. He's like a close advisor to six presidents. These men are up there. John Kenneth Galbraith, you know, not only would he be stand alongside JFK through his early career and literally be ambassador to India during his time. Kennedy wanted him to be ambassador to Russia, which was obviously massive responsibility, but he didn't want any of that. He went there. But you look at these people are some of the most powerful people. He also wrote his the speech that Johnson would give when Kennedy got assassinated. These people played both sides in the same sense. As soon as their guy's dead and been shot in the head, the very next day they're writing the speech for the next guy.
Right.
Don't believe that the CFR cares about the fodder that dies on the floor, like the people who get pushed to the sides. Don't think they care about them at all. They have an agenda, and the masters will have the voice. They know that when they enter into it. And it's very interesting that eventually, when Galbraith would leave the CFR in about 1974 time, he would say that it was one of the most banal and mundane things that you would have to go through, and the only question that arose from it is whether you wanted to continue sitting through it or not. So I don't think they enjoyed. He may have been like still working for the CFR in some capacity there, but really, I don't think any of them really enjoyed it. But they were there at the center of power, and it made them feel big. And all of these guys, after Klaus Schwab would help with this merger and create Sulzer AG on its own with the merger of these companies, that company would be going on straight away to, at the time, all through and afterwards, help with the South African regime's illegal nuclear weapon program to give them parts and that was against international law. So Klaus Schwab would do exactly. He would leave Harvard. He would leave this set. People were working on the thermonuclear deterrence, and he would go straight back to his father's company, and he would merge it, create Solskjaer AG, and they would deal in with a racist regime supplying them parts for an illegal nuclear weapons project that was ended up being unsuccessful, of course, but still, I mean, the crime's there. And then afterwards, Galbraith and Herman Kahn would come to Europe with Schwab, and they would drive to create the World Economic Forum.
Okay.
It did not stop.
So let's pause there for a second and tell people where exactly they can go verbally. Anyway, I'll give you guys some show notes along with the podcast, but I want you to tell us where you want people to go look at your work, anything that you want to give us there before I give you the last 15 minutes to run through, because you are fast, my friend. And loaded with information that's really, really interesting, as your articles are. So tell people about where they can go, support your work, whatever, all you. And I'm just going to sit back and listen to a little bit more about this because, frankly, I think a lot of people don't even know about the influence of the World Economic Forum because it just kind of goes by quickly in most discussions,
yeah.
And people make a lot of assumptions about it. Maybe you could hit a couple of key points there on your way out, too, because, like I said, I'm going to give you the last 15 or so. But where could we go to see what you're writing next and anything else you want to promote? Go ahead.
Okay, excellent. Well, I got loads of stuff coming up. The technique I use when I'm trying to find articles is I find stuff that no one else has found, and there's no chance probably that they're going to find it. So I get a little bit of time to actually research it, develop it, understand what's going on, attach as many sources as possible, and then put it out there. And I do that through johnnyvedmore.com, where you can find links to all the other places where I'm writing, etc. And you can find the bulk of my work. That'll also link you up to where my media section is. That's Fungi Monkey, so fungimonkey.com, and that's a place where there's loads of videos. I do loads of other things. I do music. I do police auditing, where First Amendment auditing over in America, I think you call it, with the police and stuff. So I do lots of other things, and I also write Unlimited Hangout. This article that we're talking about today is at Unlimited Hangout, but if you go to johnnyvedmore.com and you have a look, the top there is this article, and you can then either go and read the 7,000-word article on Unlimited Hangout, if that's your bag, but also underneath, John F. O'Donnell, the comedian, does a whole read-through of it, and then there's a load of videos of people breaking down the piece and other interviews with people about the piece. So I want people to explore this piece in loads of different ways, because there's actually a lot of content within it.
Right. So JohnnyVenmore.com is the main place to go, and that way you can start from there and follow all your other stuff. By the way, just really quickly again before you start up again, I'd love to sit down and talk to you about what you're calling First Amendment auditing. Any sort of watchdogging on the police is necessary at this point in time, no matter where you are in the world. Love to talk to you about that. Secondly, you are a musician, and I'd love to explore that because we have that in common at another time. But I'll just give it to you. Go right ahead and tell us how we should finish out thinking about all this. But JohnnyVenmore.com, right, is the place.
Yeah, JohnnyVenmore.com. So it's VDMORE, Johnny with a H. Come find me. It's fairly easy.
Right.
Let me explain to you something. This whole CFR, these agencies like the Royal Society in the UK, they're like round table groups, and this comes from the Rhodesian ideas from the past, because for people who don't know, there was once a great man, they say, in who was a South African mine owner, industrialist, a landowner, authoritarian, called Cecil Rhodes, who lived in the 1800s, and he amassed great wealth, but he also amassed an ideology that was similar to something that everybody's heard about. And lots of people mistake Cecil Rhodes and the Rhodesian power group and control structure for being what is known as the Illuminati. So the Illuminati has this pyramid structure. Someone's on top, and it's supposed to be then trickles down. So there's a group on top who have all the power, and then they tell the people underneath what to do, and it comes down until you've got the schmucks at the bottom. Well, this is the same thing, but Cecil Rhodes Rhodes looked at it from kind of like a bird's eye view. So a pyramid from the top was the center of the pyramid. The point would be the central round table, the people who have the real significant sway, the people who have all of the money and the power. And then they would be in control. Each of those would be in control of different round table groups. So then they would section off, each one of them would be in control of another round table group. Then those would be in control of another round table group. And the CFR are one of these. They're one of these round table groups that comes from really the, I think it's the sixth or seventh will and testament of Cecil Rhodes, where he left all of his money, this extremely rich man who had this idea about how Anglo-American supremacy was the way forward for the world. And he had some amazing, I mean, they had some amazing ideas. In 1922 or 23, the Rhodesian ideal was put forward as being the future for the domination of the world is there is currently three massive power blocks in the world. This is in the early 20s. There's three massive power blocks. There's the Anglo-American power block, Britain and the colonies and America, and then there's the European power block, which was going to be Nazi Germany, and then there was the Russian power block. And they realized that if they owned two or three of the power blocks, they win the game. And that's how Cecil Rhodes saw things. He saw it is important that the Anglo-American empire should be combined. And that kind of ideology went on through years and years and has trickled through society in also many ways. And it's true. If you break down reality, what you get is that if you've got three pieces and two of them are joined up, they overpower the other piece in any game. So we know that this was something that they were creating, but we can see it in the work of Herman Kahn, especially. He would actually talk about this in his work, The Year 2000, which looked at all of the technology that would come in the next 30 years from 1967. And it's amazing. They used game theory, so they mapped out everything, and they're nearly completely accurate. I mean, it's a lot of the technology they envisioned back in 1967, we still haven't got to yet, but we know it's possible, and we know we're going there, so it's quite incredible. But he also saw other things. He said that really the desire for all of these people that he was working with was to have a combined Anglo-American superstate, to combine the English-speaking world into one big power block. And then what would be even better than that was if Europe would join in with that, and then they would be able to forge world peace because they'd have the domination over the rest of the world. And that is what we're seeing a lot of the time. To make this so, and to have this weird, like, I mean, it sounds like a really over the top conspiracy. You'd have to have everybody involved, but you don't. You just have to select the leaders. And as Herman Kahn explains in his 1967 Year 2000 and his ancillary document, you'd have to give them, instill them with shared common values that they would then go on to instill to their populations. So these special leaders would be educated separately from society from a young age to instill and decide what values we have and what our shared common values would be. And if we fast forward now, we can see that not only happen through the World Economic Forum Young Global Leader Project again and be more refined at that next time and continue all of the way through to get better and better at doing what they're doing, but they don't only, you're right, they don't only get the top leaders. They get a load of different people who are going to be lifted up throughout their careers and are going to seem disconnected. They don't seem like they're part of this big homogenous globalist group that are all looking, they're all people who are individuals who are looking for power. And it will create, the system they're creating will create two tiers of society, a very small upper class and a very large, what they call peasant class, what Herman Kahn would refer to them as, or underclass. Yuval Noah Harari, I think, would refer to them as the rats. So we get to the rhetoric. If we listen to how these people speak, we get to understand that we are like a livestock to them. Even Herman Kahn would say, when he's talking about his Year 2000 with the Anthony J. Weiner, who did it alongside him, part of the Hudson Institute as well, they would say, you know, oh, why don't we just put tranquilizers in the water supplies if everybody gets a little crazy in the future? You know, their ideas are the basic dystopian principles to control a class that they can see coming, because they've done all of the math. Herman Kahn did the game theory in the year 2000, shows that. Later on, he would be devastated when the Club of Rome would do their speech of the World Economic Forum, because Herman Kahn and John Kenneth Galbraith would be keynote speakers up front at the first World Economic Forum. But by 1973, Klaus Schwab had invited a load of eugenicists and people who believed in population control to keep the thing going, because it was floundering a little bit. And Herman Kahn would become devastated by this and would write another document just a few years after, called The Next 200 Years, where he said, you know, we didn't have to worry about the future. Resources weren't the problem. We've got loads of, like, possibilities in the future. But one of the big things and the big warnings that he gave, and there's something that is really important and possibly really important to end this on, is that if we don't learn with all of these new technologies, we've got massive paradigm shift in technologies approaching. If we think atomic warfare and nuclear warfare caused as much political and social turmoil as we've seen over the past 50 years, you wait for some of the technologies that we've got coming up in the next 10 years that are even more powerful than that. And there'll be 5 or 10 of them, and they'll be increasing exponentially. And Herman Kahn warned very clearly, if we're not ready for this, then we're gone. We're not going to survive. And that was really important, that we don't leave people in charge who are just going to keep propelling us towards a future of danger, because we're not advanced enough to cope with the technologies that we're able to produce.
Well, see, and that's why in their minds, it appears, according to the philosophy that is universal, you must have a two-tier system when it comes to education. And that's something that a lot of people have a hard time understanding, because there's a reason why most people in America only speak one language. There's a reason why the majority are not educated properly. It's because they're not meant to be in charge. See, That's the thing. All those theories, those game theories, those very complex things, yes, we have access to a great deal of information nowadays, but still, we are not the general public, are not entitled to this other information. Because we're not supposed to be in charge. It's literally
They state it in the document. Herman Kahn actually says the university should be for basically creating like an administrative serf class.
Yeah.
So that's what we see is an education to a degree.
Right.
An education to a degree.
Literally. And then when you get to the other tier, that is something entirely alien to what it is that, say, you or I could do going to college. Okay, it's just that simple. So the two-tier education system is meant to preordain who it is that is chosen, okay, to be given the special education to become that part of that other class, which does wind up running things, and it's a top-to-bottom situation. See, if you only take over the management, and I don't remember if it was Kahn or if it was somebody else, who basically said the one error that people were making at a certain point in our history was trying to only take over the upper echelon. That is not all there is to it. You have to have the administrative control all the way through. And this is impressed upon people in special education, and I don't mean special education as in special people. I mean education that is completely segregated from the majority of those that go and learn a profession, an administrative role that has really no power at all. But you might be able to be a bureaucrat. That's a possibility, but you don't actually wield any power. The powerful are educated in a different reality entirely. So that's the case, and that is what we're looking at here. And again, the World Economic Forum, still one of those things that is often mentioned and completely misunderstood, especially because nobody has a handle on who is actually running that thing. You can see the actions a bit, but then again, we're restricted, just like from the real news, just like from the real history.
And understand, he's a supreme leader. He's a supreme leader. There's no hierarchy structure apart from him at the top.
That's the way it is. And there you have it. So again, Johnny Venmore, johnnyvenmore.com. Okay, that's your one-stop shop. Go there, read his articles, get into them, and don't just read them once. because, as he said, he wants people to explore these things and get into them and think about the context of all the stuff he just threw at you with an hour. Okay? It'll take you a lot longer than that to discover and go through these things, I assure you. What'd you say, 7,000 words on that that article with the homage to Dr. Strangelove? I mean, that's a bit of reading, my friend. But do it. Okay, do it and check out the other interviews. Obviously, you got my style this time, but Jason Burmis did a great interview on this with you, and other people too. So by all means, johnnybenmore.com, and thank you, sir, for joining me today. I really appreciate it, and I also appreciate your patience putting up with my Elmer Fudd joke and every other piece of nonsense. Thanks.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been nothing but a pleasure, my man. I love your energy.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com. But oh, look at that! I'm accidentally running my closing music. we had a little bit of a confusion during the break. We were trying to straighten out some audio issues, but we finally got it, and I'm looking forward to this. Here again is another situation where I'm not going to have to say much. Okay, I've got two guests, and I've got two great ones for you. And hopefully I don't screw up anybody's name as I go forward. Now, David Gallup is easy to say, so I think that's right. I got that one all right. however, when we look at Arthur Kangas, I could be right about that, or I could be wrong. Is that
Kangas is fine, but anything you say, just don't call me late to dinner.
Fair enough. Now, I have had conversations with individuals like this before, and one of them is connected to the World Citizen Organization there, and I discussed a documentary on this show a while back that had something to do with that, and that spurned like 2 weeks of conversations on my show. So I will be more than happy to sit back and listen to both of you guys. Tonight, though, we're going to talk about Ukraine a bit. But first, since we had that little bit of a tussle with the Skype and such during the break, I'd like each of you guys to introduce yourselves. So let's start with Arthur, and I don't want to screw up your name again. Kangas?
Yes, that's absolutely right.
Now I got it.
I'm Arthur Kangas. I am director of the film The World Is My Country, and was very pleased to be on your show before. And it's a very interesting documentary about an amazing guy who was a citizen of no nation, only the world, for 65 years, and kind of a pioneer in saying, hey, look, isn't this kind of crazy having our world divided up and run by corporations and money interests? It's only because we, the people, are locked in these boxes called nation states. We've got to step above them and take our rightful place as the governors of our small planet. Anyway, he basically is saying that world citizenship is the key to getting our power back. And my own background is I've been a filmmaker and an activist for years. I made a film with Paul Newman two of them. I made The World Is My Country, and I made A Spot Which Ran Before the Day After, and I was the nuclear war researcher on that film. So I've been using the power of film to make a difference for a better world for most of my life.
That's right, and we wound up discussing The Day After on that show. We wound up, and like I said, it did lead to a whole bunch of conversations. We wound up reading stuff from Lucy Parsons and all kinds of stuff for weeks on the show, just so you know.
Good to hear it.
You
we
inspired,
stirred up the pot.
Oh, you inspired all kinds of discussions about the real concept of anarchy, about what it is to be connected to these different organizations and to be, a citizen, so to speak. And really, we had to break a lot of things down. after you were on the show. So I'm very glad to have you back for sure. But don't feel bad at all, Mr. Gallup, because I'm glad to have both of you tonight, and I'm just going to let you guys roll with this discussion because we're going to talk about Ukraine a bit, aren't we? But, Mr. Gallup, if you could introduce yourself to the audience, I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having us on tonight. My name is David Gallup. I'm a human rights lawyer, and for almost 25 years up until his death, I worked with Gary Davis, who is the subject of Arthur's film, The World is My Country, working at World Service Authority in Washington, D.C., which is a global public service human rights organization that was actually founded in 1954. I've been there since 1992. I'm still at that organization. I'm its chief attorney, but also the president of the organization. And we have a legal department, which was what I had come to the organization back in 1992 to start, to help the global public, people in especially refugee and stateless situations, find legal advocacy, whether it's writing a legal brief to support their right to stay in a place where they found a safe haven. We've seen that now dramatically with what's going on with all the refugees from Ukraine, but not just Ukraine, but a lot of other countries where wars are going on in the world. What's one of the biggest problems? War, environmental problems and refugee problems are two of the biggest problems that wars cause. So we have that legal advocacy department of the organization, and probably the organization, the World Service Authority, is best known for the World Passport. It's a document of global identification and travel. 95% of all countries have recognized it on a case-by-case basis, but not always, and that's why we have a legal department to back up the validity of that document. It's especially well recognized in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East. Much probably harder to use, I would say, in North America and Western Europe, which are the most restrictive countries. But the main focus really of the organization, as Arthur mentioned about Gary Davis in the film The World is My Country, is the Thomas Paine quote that, I see myself as a citizen of the world. And of course, Thomas Paine wasn't the only person who said that. Socrates said that. Diogenes, way back in ancient Greece, said, called themselves citizens of the world. So it's an idea of bringing humanity together, not to give up any other allegiance that we've given to any of our local regions or areas or countries or anything, but to add that higher awareness or other awareness of our link to all human beings and to the earth. So I've been working there this is my 31st year there.
Now, just a full sort of disclaimer here. I want everybody to know that generally I turn down most lawyers to be on the show. I have literally very little use for people in your profession. I'm going to tell you right now, but when somebody's doing good work, they're doing good work no matter how they do it. So just to let you know, people that are lawyers, generally I go, lawyer, never mind. I don't care what book he wrote. I don't care what he's doing, unless you're doing something positive. So you are here under that proviso, just so you know.
No worries. Don't worry. I hear that almost every day. People call in and say, well, you're a lawyer? I don't know. I'm not sure I want to talk with you, but I am not your standard lawyer at all.
No, I don't
quote unquote practice law per se. I'm much more on the educational side of helping people to understand that they have rights and they need to know them and they need to claim them and to help them to do that, not to take their money. I don't get any money from any individual by representing them in a so-called court of law.
Okay. No, fair enough. Look, I don't care how you make your money, you understand. I'm very gangsterish in that way. I don't care how a man makes his living, But the thing is that it's just, I got a thing against lawyers. All right. Anyway,
I get it.
But as long as we can have fun, we're good, and we're going to educate people here because there is a lot to be said. Now, you said something, so I'm going to start off with you, Mr. Gallup. Even though I want to talk to Mr. Kanagas a bit too, for sure. But here's the thing: you said something there that I've been saying, and I've gotten myself in trouble for saying now, and it kind of hinges with the thing that gets me in trouble. War itself automatically creates not only, the absolute, people say, oh, it's war crimes and they're targeting civilians, as if this is a surprise, as if this is special, as if people being displaced doesn't happen every time, no matter what nation it is, no matter what the cause is, no matter what the reality is, no matter what the geopolitical ramifications of it are. Here's a reality for everybody to understand. There will be refugees. There will be displaced people. There will be individuals who are now vulnerable, who have now been set into a position where they are at the whim of circumstance. That is a guarantee. Every time you see one of these military actions, without fail, I mean, unless it's something that lasts, you know, 2 weeks, maybe, you won't see that. But when you see anything that is a military action, the absolute result is always going to be partially that people are displaced, that people lose their homes, and they are still people. And I don't care where they are. This is something that needs to be understood. We're all on the same planet. Okay, we're all here. You want to argue about the shape of it? Go ahead, but we're all here. Okay, and we're all subject to this, even though Americans might not remember that so well. We're all subject to this possibility, and you need to have this in your mind. So, am I right or wrong about having that sentiment?
You're absolutely right. War is a crime. In every single nation on Earth, it's against the law to murder people, to blow up their homes and schools and factories in every single nation. And suddenly you step outside of nations and, well, it's legal, but as long as you do it a certain way, you know, you got to do it this way and that way, or else you might be committing a crime. But otherwise, it's perfectly fine. Go ahead, kill people. Well, this is insane. And it's especially insane when we realize it's all based on a myth. And that is this myth of the hero with the big gun. We see it in movies and TV shows and everything, that somehow there's the bad guys, and we try every way we can to reason and so on. But finally, the good guys can't take it anymore. They've got to use superior violence, blow away the bad guys, and ride off into the sunset with the girl. You know, and this is a totally false myth. I mean, do you know anybody in your life who blew away the bad guys and lived happily ever after? I mean, it doesn't really happen. And when you step back and look at this small planet, as you mentioned, you see an incredible insanity. And that is, insanity is when you do the same thing over and over again and it never works, and then you just try harder and more. Well, war never works. Mm-hmm. Take a look. The powerful Soviet empire pounded on Afghanistan for years and years, and they couldn't beat these tribesmen in the jungle. And then we took over, and for 20 years we pounded them, and we had the most incredible, powerful military force in the world against an incredibly small, one of the poorest countries on Earth. And all we did is drive them more and more into the hands of extremists, because who wouldn't be extreme when your country is being pounded by another country? And they oppressed women more, everything else, because war makes it suddenly okay to do all the horrible things inside your society. That's when we locked up Japanese during World War II, something we would never do. But it's a war, okay, we can do it. Hitler killed people in concentration camps because there was a war. War made it so you can exterminate people now. It's okay. And so we look at this insanity. And we could even say, you know, you might ask the question, well, okay, maybe war doesn't work for these big powers because they just make the small countries more resistant. But what about the little nations? Well, okay, here's the valiant people who are standing up to Soviet tanks right now. We've seen their incredible, this little country taking on this mighty military force and holding their own. And you have to say, wow, isn't their military power working? Well, let's contrast that to Lithuania. That's where my grandfather came from. And I went back and visited there. And I met with the first head of state of Lithuania, who had led the singing revolution, Landsbergis. And here, when the mighty Soviet Empire was there, when Russia was the mighty Soviet Empire, they were the first country to break away. And how did they do it? With a singing revolution. The tanks came pouring in, just like they're doing today. In Ukraine, but they came pouring in, and the mighty Soviet army was determined to defeat these breakaway people who were trying to claim their independence. And they were greeted by crowds of singing people. And I talked to a tour guide. He said, well, I climbed up the TV tower and I was saying, you know, the tanks are coming down Revolution Avenue. What did they do? Run away from the tanks? No, everybody ran to the tanks. They all blocked them. They said, you know, hey, you're our brothers, you know, come sing with us. This isn't, and you know what? 14 people were killed. 14 protesters, and they lament those, they miss those people, and the mighty Soviet army was defeated by a nonviolent revolution, and all their cities are intact, their hospitals are intact, their maternity wards, their nation's not pulverized. So the idea, there's no such thing as military force, that's a military farce. You know, it's a farce. It's been pulled over our eyes, a phony idea. There is no military power. It's military powerlessness. The power comes in other ways. And what we're here to talk about is two very powerful alternatives to war.
Mm. That's an incredible story and also perfectly stated. I appreciate that a lot. And that was Mr. Kanagas giving you that explanation. So just to identify it, but let's take this now into the current situation. But again, no matter what, okay, when you see this conflict, this invasion, that, it appears as though when people decide to clash with it, this is the honest result, these displaced people, one way or another, people that had no stake in the situation, they will be affected. So, with Ukraine, we have the circumstance that, again, I don't trust any of the media, right? So I'm not trusting the hero's journey they're trying to give to Vladimir Putin in some corners. I don't trust the hero's journey they're trying to give to the Ukrainian president. I don't trust any of this because it's a grand narrative. And it doesn't explain what's actually happening here. So let's talk about the alternatives. What could be happening? What is happening? I mean, where do we begin?
Well, let me let David jump in a little bit first, or I would keep going, but I...
Please. Okay.
I want to include him.
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, Chuck, when you say that, is the military-industrial complex. I mean, we're living in a system that rewards big industry for producing weapons of destruction, whether they're mass destruction or minor destruction, they're still weapons. What I like to say is a knife is a weapon, but with that knife, I can cut up my dinner salad, but I really can't cut up my dinner salad with a nuclear bomb. Mm. all it can do is kill. And the fact that we are not only maintaining the whatever it is, 20,000 or so nuclear weapons that still exist on the planet, but we're also engineering new ones. So it's that system, that war system that benefits industry and that benefits politicians that is keeping the war system going. And I think we have to question that. I mean, in the war on terror, so to speak, for example, there are rules about, you know, for example, compliance of who like any individual or an organization in the United States could help. Like, you cannot provide any kind of service or assistance to someone in Iran because the U.S. government doesn't like Iran, so you have to get like a special license to do that. Well, why don't we have regulations that pertain to production and sale and distribution of weapons and make that illegal? Well, war actually was made illegal by the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928. And it's never been revoked. So war is actually still illegal, despite the fact that there are the Geneva Conventions, that is international humanitarian law, that allows, as Arthur was saying, for wars to be fought as long as they don't target civilians, as long as it's quick and winnable. Well, but most wars now do target civilians. In fact, you know, whether we believe the press reports or not, it's usually about 80% of all casualties in wars nowadays are civilians. Or, of course, if they aren't casualties, then as you said, Chuck, they have fled to other neighboring countries. And even when it's not a full-scale international conflict like this happens to be in Ukraine and Russia now, just look at what happened to the almost a million Rohingya refugees who had to flee Myanmar over the last couple of years because their villages were being burned. They had to go to Bangladesh, and it wasn't really an international war. It was really an internal conflict, but those people are stateless. They never were given citizenship by the government of Myanmar, and because of the violence, they had to leave. So whether it's an outright international conflict or an internal conflict, law is what is missing, and weapons, unfortunately, are what happens to be maximized.
Well, not only that, but there's the ancillary benefit of rebuilding, of, you know, supplies. See, that's the other thing here, is even when we talk about this support of nations and everything else, you know, well, we're going to send aid, this and that. There's a for-profit system around that. That is not, you know, we're going to rebuild the city. Sure you are. You're going to make a ton, too. I remember even after Desert Storm, I was offered something like $10,000 a month, which was pretty good right after Desert Storm, to go over and be a piece of unskilled labor in Iraq, right? Or maybe it was Kuwait. I forget. But either way, this was a job offer out there. 10 grand a month, way more than an unskilled laborer would have made normally. But that's because of the extremely lucrative contracts for rebuilding in this, too. So this is a cyclical thing that goes on. It's not just about the profit from the weapons and the planes and the helicopters that crash and need maintenance. It's about all of it. And then the building of bases after things have been established. I mean, it's a complex and dynamic business model, isn't it?
Yes. And Eisenhower, you know, Eisenhower warned us of that. Here's the president of the United States, a general, and his farewell address to the nation, his final warning, he says, wake up, folks. He says, every single city, every municipality, everything, all the power has gone to the military-industrial complex, and that he warned us that every gun that is made, every warship launched, represents in the final sense a theft from those who are hungry and not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. We pay not just with our blood, but with actually the sacrificing the very democracy that keeps us going. And he predicted what's been happening. President Kennedy said the weapons of war must be abolished or they'll abolish us. And yet we're racing toward abolishing the human race in the name of profit. The movie Don't Look Up is a good one. Hey, we're going to make more profit if we let that meteor hit. Let's just try to do it in a way we can mine all the stuff from it. And you know, and then we end up blowing up the world because we think we can make money off it. I mean, what kind of insanity is that? And there are alternatives. There are alternatives that work, and that's one of the key things we want to talk about.
Right, so let's get to it. I mean, we know vaguely, at least, what the circumstance is, but I'll tell you that you don't know until after action what really went on during any of these conflicts. Doesn't matter that we have satellite images or not. The truth of what's on the ground is only going to be known afterwards. Okay,
well,
so...
To me, it doesn't really matter. In every situation, each side is right from their viewpoint, not from the other. Each one's getting different information.
Right.
The key thing we need is not to decide who's right and wrong, but look at this as a systemic problem. I mean, if we step back and look at planet Earth, we have to say that, my God, we've got a really broken way of governing this poor world, and it's going to lead to it crashing and burning. We've got to step back and say, what's a sane way to govern this world? And, you know, a sane way is beginning to emerge. It's beginning to happen. And it's amazing. It actually goes back to a very revolutionary, simple concept that America's founders said in the Declaration of Human Rights. They said it is the right of the people to institute new government. It's the right of the people. They talk about, you know, old guys in gray wigs or you and I. Well, if we have the right to institute new government, what are we doing being stuck in these broken nation-state systems? Why don't we, the people, come together and invent an entirely new form of governance at the global level that brings to the top the highest and best wisdom of each individual and amalgamates that into the wisdom of humanity? The combined, this is what Gary Davis talks about in our movie and what he lived in his incredible adventures as a world citizen in the World Is My Country movie. And it's a startling idea, but very simple, because, you know, that's what they never expected us to stay stuck in those horse and buggy era broken systems. We were supposed to evolve further, and it's time that we do so. We have these incredible tools of the internet. We have these Zoom conferences all over. We interact around the world, and yet we're stuck in this old broken system that's downright crazy. I mean, there are no really lines around this planet. We invented these lines, and over these lines we kill each other. And we can invent something much better, folks.
It's why I love you, and I love that movie, by the way, that you put together there. It was really incredible. And I'm actually a nasty critic of documentaries, too, almost as bad as I am with lawyers. But the truth is that you put together something very, very interesting and thought-provoking there. And what you're talking about now, this is a hard concept for people to swallow because it's been such a given that, you know, who are you? Right down to your identity, right? You're supposed to identify yourself as what? Well, you know, people argue about gender and this and that. And, okay, now what is your nationality? It's got to come up next, doesn't it? So this idea of a nation, this idea, I never understood why it couldn't be expanded. You know, the imaginary lines, again, it's not like you go to the border of anywhere. I mean, even if you're in the United States, you go to, you know, where Mexico borders us. There's no line there. You know, it's on a map. It's a fiction. If we started to function in common ideals, which are, see, again, I always got to go back to the speeches of the 60s, a lot of them, where they were talking about, you know, occupying the same planet, breathing the same air. Like, that concept came around and then was sort of shelved. So what is it that we do about this so that we don't continue to justify murder, you know, through the convention of war? Okay, what is it that we do to put a stop to that?
Well, I would jump in and say, because I know a lot of times when I'm talking about world citizenship, people do sort of step back and are either turned off or turned away, at least initially, until I explain the way Gary Davis explained it to me. And that is, we're not here to, quote unquote, get rid of the nation state. We're here to actually rid the nation state of anarchy between the states, meaning there's nothing wrong per se with any national government, you know, if it's not killing, obviously. And we can be proud to be a citizen of a particular place. And there's nothing really wrong with that. But it's the anarchy between them, because there is no common law or common, what I would like to call common world law, that just like here in the United States, and this harks back to what Arthur was saying at the beginning, you know, here in the United States, if you shoot someone in Kansas, you can't flee to Missouri and get away with murder. You will go on trial, and if you know, there's enough facts to prove it, and in court you're found guilty, you will suffer the consequences of jail or whatever else. But that doesn't necessarily exist internationally, and certainly in times of war, it definitely doesn't exist. There could be if you're wearing a military uniform, you are paid to kill. Gary Davis, as a bomber pilot in World War II, dropped bombs on Brandenburg, and when he was up in that plane, even though at first, you know, he went up, he's like, I've got to kill these, either kill, you know, stop the war factories that Hitler created, because they killed my brother. His brother was killed in on his battleship in Salerno. And he said, well, you know, once I was up in that plane dropping bombs, I realized that although my brother was killed, I was killing brothers. How come those people who killed my brother didn't go to jail? How come I didn't go to jail for killing those people in Brandenburg? And his revenge really turned to remorse and guilt, shame for what he had done. And so to bring that up here to the 21st century is to say, look, one of the things we're doing on a day-to-day basis at World Service Authority is to educate the public that we are world citizens, that it's a valid, legitimate status that we can claim to not, like I said, get rid of any other status that we might claim, but to add that higher awareness of our link to all humans and certainly to the Earth, which is our only home. And we know, and I sort of alluded to this before, but war is the biggest despoiler of the environment, both preparations for war and, as you were saying, Chuck, the destruction of cities and just having to rebuild that. Just think of all the energy that we're spending and resources just to rebuild something that, you know, didn't have to be destroyed for any reason in the first place. And because I'm a lawyer, I like to hark back to principles of law, but I think you'll appreciate this. And you know, even beyond natural law, like doing good, making sure no one is harmed, that. But even the principle of world citizenship is valid if you look at it through the lens of how nation states determine who is a citizen, you know, what is our identity. And there are two main principles that every nation state uses, either one or both, which are jus soli and jus sanguinis. Jus soli means the right of the earth. Jus sanguinis means the right of the blood or the heritage. So in the United States, for example, if your parents are American, well, you are American because your bloodline, you might say, is American. And if you were born, in Illinois, you're an American, so you have that citizenship. But even if you were born, in international waters on a cruise ship or something, as long as your parents are American, then you're American. But not all countries do that. There are some countries where, by blood only, you can't just be born on the land, you get that citizenship. But with world citizenship, both principles of jus soli and jus sanguinis apply. All human beings are born of human parents, so our blood, our heritage, our DNA is human or Homo sapien, and we're all born on the land, which is planet Earth. So that makes us world citizens legally, politically, and officially. But as Gary Davis would say, we have to claim it. No one's going to claim that for you. You have to claim your own status at that level if you choose it. And that was what he spent his entire adult life doing. That's what I've spent pretty much my entire adult life at World Service Authority, is educating people to get what it means to be a world citizen, meaning we have rights and duties to each other that should be respected no matter where we find ourselves on planet Earth.
Yeah, and see, go ahead. Go ahead.
I might just jump in and say that, people say, well, we have to fight wars because there's these bad guys doing terrible things. It's kind of the other way around. It's because we have wars that these bad guys are doing terrible things. I mean, look around the world. Every case you talk about where countries are repressing human rights, doing horrible things, it's always because, look, there's all these outside enemies around there. We're surrounded. We're being bedadgered. We've got to repress human rights because then you're supporting the enemy. And it's always, you can't fight for war for freedom. War is what suppresses freedom. Freedom is freedom. When we have freedom from war, that's how we build a free planet where all of us have rights and freedoms. Look at everyone. Every single case where you see people repressing human rights, it's because it's based on that we've got a war, an outside enemy to protect ourselves from. And actually, if you look around, not only environment, but almost every single problem we face that seems insurmountable and unsolvable when we're stuck inside this broken nation state system, becomes eminently solvable when we step beyond it and put above our national citizenship, becoming citizens of the world and being citizens of the world. As David said, we already are legally. We just have to declare it and claim it.
Well, somebody might say, what is the benefit of doing that? Because a lot of people fear this idea of a unified world, one way or another, right? Where, look, if we give it all to one government, yeah, of course, especially because a unified government, I mean, all I know from governments is their ability to negotiate violence, really. That's right. Really what I see. So somebody might say, well, why not embrace the concept of there's no need for it if we're all here, actually, and you don't have the separation of the nation states? Frankly, what would be the purpose? Oh, well, they're going to fight over resources. See what I mean?
Here's what Gary Davis says. In our movie, he says, does world government scare you? Well, it does me if it's the same old forces of power and money controlling our lives from behind closed doors, the new world order they've talked about. He said, but what if we run it? What if we invent and discover new ways of doing it? He says, we humans are an incredibly ingenious species. Why squander our genius inventing smart bombs to do ourselves in? Why not invent new interactive systems from the bottom to a bottom-up democracy, and we're already getting all these tools on the Internet to do it, where we evolve a way that brings to the top not the worst but the best of people. For example, he had this whole idea of these integrity groups now growing into – David can talk a little more about this, about decentralized units basically that what the basic idea was that – we can invent something new, and it's beginning to happen. Already we're all connecting, interconnecting around the world, kind of forming a cyber interrelation with other people. We've now, all the old ideas are out the window that, like, currencies had to be French or U.S. or German. Now we're inventing cryptocurrencies. Gary invented the kilowatt dollar, a world money, way before other people started talking about cryptos. And if you can imagine, instead of win-lose democracy, like when 50% win, 51% win, 49% lose, and then you fight out next time, people don't bring up their best, and it's a race to the bottom. We get the worst ideas of everybody because you've got to make enough to just make your 51% and get your side to win versus the other side. But if you take those same people and you say you take a Zoom call, and it's like a Zoom call, but it's this integrity group, and you have people who are, you know, Trump and Biden supporters, or is Arabs and Israelis, or take any side of a conflict. And there have been many cases where people have done this. There's many wonderful films about it. And you get them in a room together, and you don't say who's right and who's wrong, because then you just paddle it out and you get nowhere. And you say one side's going to get win out the vote the other. But if you instead get together and you say, okay, what is it you really want in life? What are your deepest aspirations? What's your story? You know, what's your and you find that all over people want the same thing. They want a better life for their children. They want to be safe and secure. They want to not have somebody suppressing them. They want freedoms. They want their rights. And they always think that it's the bad guys causing it, and they've got to fight them. But once you bring them together, you know, like there's a movie, Free Trip to Egypt, where this guy stood in the Trump rally and had a sign, Free Trip to Egypt. And he got these people who were very anti-Arab and anti-Islam, and they were living in homes with people who were Islamic. And they said, gee, we wish all Islamic people were like you. And the Islamic people said, we wish all Jews were like you. You know, once you connect people at a human level, you find great connections. And, you know, it's this broken system that's tearing us apart. People have a natural inclination to do good. In fact, the amazing thing is that all over the world, everybody's trying to do good. Look at the suicide bomber. Here's somebody so dedicated to God, so dedicated to trying to help his fellow people, that he's willing to take his own life and blow himself up. What dedication. You know, look at every single issue, every single side. Everybody's right. But they're right given a different set of information. They're not getting the same sets of information. So their inclination to do good is being mischanneled into something that's going to destroy the world. Our inclination to good can be tapped to bring us together into what Gary called a people-powered planet. If we invent the right systems that bring to the top the highest and best wisdom of every single individual on the planet and amalgamate that into the wisdom of the whole, we can unleash the superpower, and that superpower is the will of the people at the global level. And then all these corporations that are doing bad, all these countries doing bad, will jump aboard and say, hey, wait a minute, we want to be there too. It's like Gandhi said, there go my people, I'm their leader, I must catch up with them. You know, you see that with companies when the environmental, you know, they'll fight something tooth and nail, like, well, seatbelts, environment, whatever else. And then once they see it's coming, they all jump aboard, put it in their ads, boast about it. You know, we the people just have to take the lead in inventing new systems to save our world, and we can do it. And time is now, because we're perilously close to total annihilation if we don't do it. So let's do it, folks.
Well, there you have it. I mean, what else can be said? David, it's... I want to think this way. I want to feel this way. I want to go this way, right?
Yep.
But people are just so resistant to this idea. It's like, that's very interesting and that's very utopian. How is it that you can bridge that gap? I mean, it's just, there's this prejudice. I mean, I don't know what else to call it. It's definitely a prejudice against opening up that idea where, no, there isn't going to be somebody that is going to automatically be the enemy one way or the other. One way or the other, you were taught about that. And it doesn't matter. I mean, it's 100 different ways. When I was a kid, you know, who was the enemy? Oh, the Soviet Union, you know. And they started telling us about those crazed people over there, too, in the Middle East that were, you know, later somebody would say they hate us for our freedoms. And it makes no sense when you break it down, because as you said, there's a commonality here. Like I was saying, you know, I go back to those speeches of the 60s, which various people echoed. And it was like, look, there is a universal understanding that can be come to, you know, between people, no matter who they are, right? I mean, I know that there are some people that are, you know, out there and everything else. But I think if they weren't pressurized by the existing system, you might not have as much of that either.
Absolutely.
So it's a tough thing to get through. So how do we logically get through this? I'm going to go to the lawyer now. How do we logically get through this? Because somebody would say, look, legally, I don't know how to embrace. I don't know how to declare this. I don't know how to change my status. I don't know how to begin to engage in this. So what do you do?
Well, I mean, on a very basic level, one of the things that World Service Authority does on a day-to-day basis is actually provide documents of global identification and travel. And the very basic one, probably the most important one in the mind of, say, Gary Davis, is to get a World Citizen Card and certificate that we issue. That just when you get that document in your hand, it sort of opens your eyes. And Arthur can tell the story after I'm done here about the refugee and what Gary did when he handed him a world passport, if you'd like to tell that, Arthur. But this idea of seeing this document in your hand, you start to recognize, okay, I really am this. I'm not just one thing or another. I can be, you know, identify in multiple ways. And it can be a valid and useful, beneficial identification. I mean, if we can see ourselves as humans first and foremost, as Einstein would say, he's like, remember your humanity and forget the rest. That could lead to, you know, the kind of beautiful, peaceful world that we want. And it does seem utopian. I give you that. I mean, that even in my mind, I wonder, how do we get, you know, from here to there? And I mean, one of the things I like to say is, you know, pretend it's 1900 and you go and tell someone, well, in 69 years, we will land someone on the moon. And of course, 1900, it's 4 years before the plane took off in Kitty Hawk, right? They would think you were crazy, ridiculous. How could we send somebody to the moon? That will never happen. Well, yesterday's utopia is today's reality. And especially with the amazing tools that we have, both the human intelligence and artificial intelligence, computerization, digitalization of society, like Arthur was mentioning, we have so many tools at our disposal, tools for positive and for good. And Arthur was mentioning syntegrity, which that word is a agglomeration of two words, synergy and integrity. And syntegrity, it's really a process that came from the Buckminster Fuller, who was a scientist who created the geodesic dome, who also said we need to be building livingry instead of weaponry. And there were other scientists who took this idea of synergy and integrity and created this Syntegrity project, which would allow people to ask this sort of central question: how can we as sovereign world citizens govern our world? And it's based upon the geodesic dome, a shape which it has 30 struts. It's called an icosahedron. There's no top, there's no bottom, but it's a process that it's almost like played like a game where you come, groups of people, like 30 people, come together and discuss, well, how can we govern our world? And then they come to conclusions where everybody's viewpoint matters, because there is no hierarchy in this process. So that's one way, one tool that we could be using. In fact, we're trying to relaunch that project. We actually had launched it in the 1990s in cities all around the world. Like, there was a group of women in Sierra Leone, and it was a syntegration, as we called it, of these women. It was just women who got together and said, well, what do we need here in Sierra Leone, and how could that be helpful not only for us but women in other parts of the world? But we also had groups of men and women going through this process. But and that's just one tool. I mean, we could be thinking about governing our world, but from a very decentralized perspective, from a cryptocurrency perspective, if you will, meaning we could create DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations within our own communities that could be then linked later on to what I would call a federation of DAOs, where really, you know, the subsidiarity principle of government governs best, that governs most local, because then you have a really important vested interest in what happens in your city or your community, right? And if you can vote on that, and if you get benefits for voting and for treating other people nicely when you're interacting on that permanent ledger, so to speak, but you're interacting in a way that hopefully cannot be defrauded or whatever, but you can participate. That is a big benefit to people. So I could see how we could link DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations, as another tool in addition to Syntegrity, to help people to actually start governing our world. Because right now, yes, our world is being governed, but as Arthur said, it's being governed behind the scenes by very wealthy corporations or wealthy people or wealthy politicians. It's not being governed by us, the people of the world. And that's really one of the biggest problems, is we, the people, have been left out of this whole equation. So how do we put ourselves back into that equation of governing ourselves? Governing ourselves is so important, because really government, you might say, is not something that we definitely need or want as like a final goal. Mm. But I think it's helpful to have a government, because government supports law, law supports justice, and justice supports peace. So if we really want world peace in the end, we need some kind of, I think, democratic, participatory, world federal government system, but that is governed by us, the people. How we devise that, there's even tools for that that exist now that we could think about and act upon. There is, for example, a constitution for the Federation of the Earth that exists already that we could be implementing if we choose it. So really what it comes down to, in my mind, is not really so much the law even, but political will and the will of the people to maybe take that leap, you might say, leap of faith to say, why don't we try something new? The system of this of sovereign nation states for the, you know, since the Treaty of Westphalia, so the last 400 years or so, it might have been useful when it first was created, and it probably brought the world to where we are today with technology and getting rid of a lot of poverty and getting a little rid of diseases and other things, which is great. But now it's time for humans to mature. I always love to quote Jean-Paul Sartre, because I studied existentialism and French in college, and he said, "Nous sommes des sous-hommes à la recherche de notre humanité." We are subhumans searching for our humanity. And that's what it really means to recognize our own, each of ourselves as world citizens. We're recognizing that humanity, that we can work together if we choose to. And we definitely have the tools to. We just have to realize it. We have to take that, the fact that we have that political will, and act upon it.
Okay, so I want to take you guys a couple of minutes over the time, because we started a bit late, and I'd like to make sure that we get through a couple of points and give you a chance to tell people where to go to look up further information about what was discussed. But before we get there, and before we let Mr. Kanagas tell the story that he wanted to, that you wanted him to tell, I got a couple of little things to throw in here. One thing is that, you know, somebody might hear this and say, you know, this almost sounds like the social credit system, part of what you were talking about, that a lot of people are also very afraid of, because that is subject to manipulation and all that kind of thing. And, again, very divisive and very caste-like, where people could be stuck in circumstances well beyond their own control. When you're talking about integrating these things and, you know, this possibility. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is, I've had people on the show talking to me about the Magna Carta of 1215, mm-hmm. which already seems, and has never been revoked, by the way, already seems to answer a great deal of the question of natural law. If one looks at it carefully, what are your thoughts on that? You know, because again, you're the guy who would know about the legal ideas here. Have you ever taken a look at, and not just Magna Carta, but the law of 1215, the one that was written there? And the other thing is, what about the social credit system idea, which I can see is very subject to abuse by those that could gain a great deal of power within a system like that? What are your thoughts about those two things?
Sure. Well, I'll start with the Magna Carta. I mean, the Magna Carta has been lauded as you might say, one of the first attempts at humans recognizing that we as individuals, or at least the white wealthy landowners, perhaps, if you want to look at it in terms of 1215 or even, you know, a couple of hundred years later, had rights. And the king or the sovereign, so to speak, shouldn't just be able to, like, take away things without there being some form of redress. That's really the power, in my mind, of the Magna Carta and what it represents even today as a precursor to something that I would really refer to much more importantly now, which is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was promulgated. And Arthur can also tell that story about how in 1948, because of some of the things that Gary Davis did, that declaration was unanimously recognized. And it's still right now, probably one of the best statements, overall statements of our fundamental human rights. So, you know, does that really bring into the idea of do no harm, make sure no harm is done to others, and keep your word, you know, as natural law, so to speak, is how I understand natural law? I would say certainly the Declaration of Human Rights does that better than the Magna Carta. But it's still not enough, because the Declaration, at most, it's customary international law. It's not binding treaty. And, of course, we know that nation states don't keep their word, even if people do. So that's also a problem with the international law system. It's not really fully functioning world law. And so we need to move beyond even the legal system that we're in, because it's really not effective. It's not enough, and it will always fall flat. So that's like a quick answer to the concern about the Magna Carta. And then social credit. I would say, well, to rephrase what you said, people are already stuck in circumstances beyond their control in the current system that we're working in now. I mean, it's very hard if you're born into a, you know, a certain economic status or class or something, to get out of that. It's really takes a lot of wherewithal and a lot of luck. And oftentimes, you know, people are successful because not so much what they know, but who they know. And if you don't have that social capital to know how to even write a resume, how are you going to get out of, a very low paying job or situation? That's even from a first world perspective. Look at about the 2 billion people on the planet who are virtually starving to death, you know, who can't even necessarily think about anything other than where's my next meal. So certainly, yes, I would be also concerned about a social credit system that is unjust or unfair, or that's once again wielded by people behind a curtain, and we don't know who and what who or what are suffering and why, and rather than everybody benefiting. So certainly I'm concerned about that too, whether it's as a lawyer or just as a moral human being. I want to be living in a world where my fellow human beings' needs are met, because when they aren't, sooner or later, my needs aren't going to be met. If I'm going to allow that kind of world to continue to exist.
Yeah, I might jump in that, you know, in fact, you're worried about, like, if we had a bottom-up citizen-based world system of world governance, rather than be more oppressive and more intrusive on our lives, it would be the opposite. Because Gary said, you know, government should be a service organization. He said, take a look at, for instance, the Universal Postal Union. You know, its purpose is to deliver, you know, you've put a mail in here and it's delivered over there in West New Guinea or wherever else. You put it, you know, it was set up that back then. Now, past that, we've got ICANN that regulates the names all over the world. So nobody has, two people have the same email address or the same mm-hmm. web address. And every time you get an email or a website, you know, you pay like a 40-cent fee to a nonprofit organization that regulates that. Well, in these what David's talking about, these DAOs, these semi-autonomous organizations, if we evolve a bottom-up system of governance, it's a service to all of us. All the oppressive things that governments do, they do because they say, oh, no, we've got this terrible, dangerous system of predators and stuff out there out to get us. We've got terrorists after us. We've got, you know, whether the Russians see NATO after them or the people in Europe see Russia after them or whatever. So we've got to repress. We've got to have this system of social control. We've got to do all that stuff. Well, the people would never stand for all of that if they weren't scared shitless. They weren't scared by the nation states rattling that, oh, my God, it's our national security. We have to do it. You know, look at when we've given up freedoms. Look when all the bad things that have happened. They've always happened when one side says, oh, we have to do it to protect ourselves in this dangerous war situation. Once we abolish war, once we establish a reasonable system, it'll evolve in such a positive way. You know, our grandchildren will say, you mean, what do you mean? There'll be a museum between the U.S. and Mexico, for example, where there's a museum where people, you mean people were actually killed trying to walk across there? I mean, that sounds like a fantasy, right? But look at Europe. It happened. All of a sudden, the Berlin Wall came down and all these nations that had fought for centuries, you know, France and Germany had killed each other, you know, in two major wars and many smaller ones. And now suddenly they're all under the same roof. Now you can just drive from one to the other like it's nothing. You know, in the 70 years before You know, Gary Davis took his stand. When you watch the movie, The World is My Country, you'll see that he helped inspire the leaders of the European Union. And he took his stand there in Strasbourg, living on the border between these two countries as a world citizen. You know, couldn't get into Germany because couldn't get a visa to return to France. So he just lived on the border, and he raised all these issues of world citizenship in a powerful way. And what happened is that before this, in a continent that was torn apart by wars for hundreds of years, in the 70 years since that union was formed, not a single European nation has fought a war against another European nation in that global unit. I mean, in that European Union, and there have been wars, civil wars, like in Bosnia and so on, Serbia, but there haven't been wars between countries because now they take it to court. They resolve it another way. So we do have another way. And what happened? Did freedom go down because they did that, or did freedom go up? No, freedom goes up. War is, you can't fight a war for freedom. War is what allows all these dictators to repress freedom. It allows them to manipulate us. It allows us to put us in boxes called nation states and keep us in this cage while the forces of money and power roam free in the world. And they got the best politicians money can buy. And they don't care about national borders. They're not locked into borders. Only we, the people. We got to break out of our cage, folks. And we've got to take our rightful place as the governors of this small planet before it terminates. This is spaceship Earth, folks, and we've got to govern it in such a way that we can keep it flying, or we're toast. And I think we're going to do it. We're going to turn it around, folks. It doesn't look clear now, but it'll get clearer and clearer. And I think even this war now is making more and more people realize that, hey, we need something above these nation states, some kind of legal system, and it can't be that old broken system. If we let them do it, it's going to be repression. We've got to do it from the bottom up. It's us, folks.
So with that, I'll ask you to tell us again where we can find your film right now, because I know I've got a link to it somewhere. I definitely have watched it actually more than once. Great clips in there, interesting stuff, and a whole bunch of things going on there that I knew nothing about until I saw your film. Yeah.
Great. Just go to theworldismycountry.com, theworldismycountry.com, and you'll see it right there. And if you also go to peoplepoweredplanet.com, peoplepowered, not power, powered with an ED, peoplepoweredplanet.com, you'll see every week we have a podcast where we talk about how do we invent these new systems? How do we come together? Like this next Wednesday we have the author of The Chalice and the Blade, and we'll have her incredible talk about how we develop a partnership society. There's a lot of good stuff to see when you come to those two websites. You'll get much more detail about it there. Do come join us there. Join us, become a member of that club if you want, and you can every week learn about how do we do this, folks. And we'll be having wonderful guests. We've had the head of ICANN. We had Eleanor Roosevelt's grandson. We've had all kinds of people on this podcast. Mm-hmm. So do come join us there, and you can follow up on all this.
Right. I'll definitely give you links to the in the show notes. Everybody listening, not you, Mr. Kangas, you just gave them. But Kangas.
But Leon Eisler will be especially interesting. That's April 27th, okay. 10 a.m. Pacific, and that's 1 p.m. Eastern time. And the Chalice and the Blade is an incredible book because it showed that we actually evolved as human beings out of partnership. We didn't evolve because of the survival of the fittest and the old idea of the caveman conquering the, you know, dragging the woman by the hair and all this. That's all baloney made up by storytellers. Yeah. The reality is we came together by learning how to cooperate and to get together so this weak species of human beings could somehow survive on this planet. And now we have to go back to that partnership society where women and men are together. We don't need one side. We got to get away from the dominator culture to a bottom-up partnership culture. So come here, Ron Eisler, and join us each and every week.
Yeah, no, and this is exactly the kind of stuff I think people need to hear. I've always said that it is absolutely against our design. I don't care about who you think designed us. The fact is it's against our design to work as individuals and to separate each other from each other. It's just that simple. We are, by nature, I know this is a hot-button word, but by nature, we're conspiratorial. That's what we do. We breathe together, which is what that means. Okay?
Right.
So that is what we do. We are conspiratorial. I know that, again, not a lot of people. I bet the lawyer doesn't like to hear that. But sorry, I had to do that. But, you know, we are, by nature, psychosocial creatures. We interact with one another. We do cooperate. This is part of our natural design. Are we capable of ugly and terrible things? Yes. But is it part of our natural design? I question that all the time. So but tell us about the other website that we could be visiting as well. And for that, I go to you, sir.
Sure.
You know, because Mr. Kanagas, I'm sure if I just turned off my microphone the whole time, I could let him run. He's great. And, like, I love the way he tells his story. You get passion. You get information. You get all these interesting asides. I love it. You sound like music to me. No offense to you again, sir. But Arthur is passionate, man. I love it. Anyway, by all means, tell us where we could go to find out about the World Citizen Passport, the paperwork you were talking about. I need some ID myself. We're you know, please go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so the main website is worldcitizen.gov. That's worldcitizen.gov.org. So worldcitizen.gov.org. At that website, on the homepage, there's an apply button. When you click that apply button, it takes you to an online form that you could do on your phone, laptop, PC, tablet, whatever. You fill out the information, and it really only takes 3-4 minutes where you can actually apply for a world citizen card to help identify yourself as a world citizen, in addition to any other status that you might already have. Like I said, you don't give anything else up to add this additional recognition of who you are as a human being on planet Earth, and also to get the world passport, or for people who are undocumented, which, you know, we're living in a world where so many people may never have even had a birth certificate. And we offer a world birth certificate for people who are suffering from persecution. We have a world political asylum card. We have a world marriage certificate, a world identity card, all these documents affirming some of the fundamental human rights that have been restated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So go to worldcitizengov.org. You'll find answers to other questions about what all this represents. Some information from Gary Davis is there. Good links to other information about the law, about our rights, and how to see yourself as a human being, as a world citizen with rights that should be respected everywhere.
Absolutely. And I'm going to definitely take a look at that Declaration of Rights at that website. I would like everybody to take a look at it. Let's see what it is we can do. And by the way, we might be able to improve upon it and move forward, but that's what these discussions are for. I want to thank you guys for doing this with me. I know we took it over
right,
a little bit.
Add that.
Sorry? What?
So you're right. Improve upon it to add the rights of nature. That's one of the things to move forward.
Absolutely, yes. Sir. I agree with you. Anyway, the Ocelli Effect is done for tonight. I hope you guys learned a lot of something, because it was information packed from the beginning to the end.